The race for the White House has been unconventional, but the battle, and it does look like it will be a battle for the presidency, is just beginning. Last week, Donald Trump officially became the Republicans' nominee for president, and this week, Hillary Clinton will claim the Democratic nomination in Philadelphia. But voters on both sides, they don't seem all that excited about either candidate. According to the Pew Research Center, fewer than half of both Trump and Clinton voters strongly support their party's nominee. Last week, we heard from area Republican leaders about the fracture within their party. This week, we turn to the Democrats. What are they watching from this week's convention, and do they agree or disagree when it comes to the party platform? Joining the Closer Look Democratic Roundtable is former Congressman and delegate to the Democratic National Convention, John Barrow. Khalid Kamau is an organizer with ATL Is Ready, as well as a delegate. And Gigi Pedreza joins us as well, and she is co-founder of the social venture Yo Soy Em. Before we get into what the Democrats are doing, let's talk about what the Republicans have just done. We just saw the conclusion of the Republican National Convention, and I would like to ask each of you, what stood out? And Khalid, we'll start with you.
Other than Copygate with Melania Trump, what actually really stood out and was shocking to me was Donald Trump's super long nomination acceptance speech. And in events like that, what's always most shocking to me is not necessarily what happened or what someone said, but how it is discussed in public and how it is perceived. So what has been really shocking to me is the alarm and fear that it has struck amongst African-Americans and Latino-Americans, just people of color in general, heard that speech in a very different way than, you know, certainly white Republicans, but even moderate, you know, whites were not as alarmed by that speech, I think, as we were. I don't think that we have been as alarmed by a presidential nominee since Richard Nixon.
Specifically, what alarmed you?
He really doubled down on the language of immigrants being rapists and murderers. He doubled down on this law and order rhetoric. And even though all of the data show that crime is down, he really painted this picture of like protesters advocating for, you know, the death of police officers, and then connecting that to terrorist activity around the world. I think he painted a very scary picture that probably excited a lot of his base, but made a lot of us who have been targets of, you know, the police and targets of authorities, it made us really nervous.
Gigi, what stood out to you?
The same, the feeling of apocalyptic fear that he was trying to instill in people. Also, how ironic that Ivanka had a discourse that was pretty much democratic. I mean, she talked about equality, about mothers, about children. And then Donald Trump goes to say pretty much the opposite. So it was very ironic. It was very surprising. And it was very dangerous. You heard the calls for people to jail and lock Hillary Clinton. That's not what we do in this country. We don't lock our opponents. We don't jail people we don't agree with. So it was very dangerous. It was very sad. No plans, no strategies, just fear.
John,
the one thing that seemed to unite the warring factions of the party is their antagonism toward Hillary Clinton and their determination to keep her from becoming elected, and the escalation of the rhetoric and the irresponsibility of the charges that are marshaled in that on that behalf are just really striking. It's something we haven't seen in this country that I can remember in my lifetime. And I'm the oldest guy at this table. I can go back. I can actually remember what it was like when Richard Nixon was making his appeals to the silent majority in this country, and the sense of grievance that people had in the country as a result of the upheavals of the 60s. What we're going through right now is nothing like that. But his attempt to try and invoke that sense of grievance on the part of the Republican base is a direct throwback to that time, and I think gives us really as an opportunity as a country to show the marked progress we've made from then to now. Richard Nixon couldn't be surpassed in his unctuousness, but Trump, you know, was just, he wasn't being unctuous at all, a very bombastic, very, very striking performance in an attempt to try and rekindle that kind of sense of grievance that put together a winning plurality for Nixon.
I asked our Republican roundtable participants if they believe that the Republican Party is splintered. So I'll ask each of you, do you believe the Democratic Party is splintered? John, you'll start.
both parties are a lot more homogeneous today than they were when I was a kid. For example, each of the parties had a lot of the elements of the other in their membership. Both parties have sorted themselves out as a result of a variety of things. And yes, there are differences within the Democratic coalition, but nothing like the differences we see between the Cruz and the Trump faction, between the factions that came together in Cleveland. Nothing at all like that. There are significant differences about what we can afford to do, what we can afford to invest in on the Democratic side of the debate, but nothing like the sense of grievance, the sense of antagonism, and the sense of hostility that is the only uniting principle of the crowd that we saw in Cleveland last week.
Gigi, splintered?
I agree with John, actually. I think we all have differences in the Democratic Party, and it's actually very healthy and makes us a better party, I believe. But nothing like the Republican Party. You know, when you look at the Democratic Convention, most of the titles of the speeches are together, mean together. And, you know, I'm looking for representation, I'm looking for identities, and they're all there. So I don't think we get close to that. I think there's much more that unites us. And I think Bernie Sanders and Hillary want pretty much the same thing. Some of the main differences are in how. I think Bernie's more of an all or nothing, and Hillary's more, you know, step by step. So it's about feasibility, and I think, and timing. But I don't think we're splintered.
Khalid?
I'm actually going to push back. I'm going to disagree a little bit. I think the idea of Hillary Clinton as this uniter of the Republican Party, I think there has been this slow acceptance amongst some Bernie delegates that Hillary Clinton, you know, is the presumptive nominee, and she will likely be, you know, officially announced the nominee. But I think that in as much as this 4-day infomercial of like negative advertisement of Hillary Clinton united Republicans, I think it strengthened the spine of a lot of Bernie delegates and Bernie supporters that she is just not the right opponent for Donald Trump. I think we see the level of vitriol and animosity that unites people around opposing Hillary Clinton. There are Republicans that have been waiting to run against Hillary Clinton for a decade. And we see the polls tightening up. And I think that there is a real sense of dread, I know, amongst many progressives that if only one or two of us stay home, Donald Trump could become the next president of the United States. And poll after poll after poll show that Bernie beats Donald more decisively. There's an angst and an urgency that a lot of Bernie delegates are feeling that we still have a few days yet to do this course correction. And I think no one could argue after watching the Republican convention that were we to come out of this convention and pick Bernie Sanders, the entire strategy for this election that Republicans have been building for the past 6 months would have to be rethought.
Jim, let me jump in on that for a second, because the votes have been cast and the votes have been counted. They haven't been tallied at the convention yet, but they're going to be. The votes have been cast, and we know who the nominee is going to be. And I would emphasize for folks who think that we should somehow take our cue from the Trump crowd as to who our candidate ought to be. Beware of Greeks when they're bearing gifts, okay? I come at Hillary's negatives, which is the issue that folks want to talk about. There is a false equivalence between the negatives that the public opinion has about Hillary Clinton as opposed to Donald Trump. He's earned his negatives the old-fashioned way. Hillary, on the other hand, I kind of honor Hillary for the negatives that she's gotten, because they've been such a concerted effort, a result of a nonstop 30-year campaign of vilification that's so unfounded it really symbolizes what's wrong with the politics of today, that some folks who can't change their mind and won't change the subject will keep hurling the same kind of mud at somebody, hoping that sometime it'll stick. That the determination and the ability to withstand that and stick with that is something that I honor. All of this business about who would be our best person to go up against Trump is really going to be beside the point at the end of this week. The voters have spoken.
Khalid, you'd like to respond?
Yes. One of the things that's always been amazing and amazingly frustrating for me as a progressive watching conservatives is their ability to fall in line. Republicans can consistently nominate mediocre candidates. There is a way of hierarchical thinking that is sort of just pervasive in the right, in conservative circles. Like they are predisposed to that. On the left, you have this same sort of frustration. We just have a very different culture on our side, which makes the nomination of a divisive candidate a lot less likely to be successful.
So I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this. You're saying that as much as you hate to say this as a progressive, that you would like Democrats to coalesce and hold their nose if they have to and vote for Hillary Clinton because the consequences at stake are too great.
Yes, but that is not our nature.
Yeah. And I agree. And I appreciate and I feel like what Khalid says. And I personally really like Bernie Sanders, what he says and like him. But we have to play to win. That's what I believe. And to the people that are not sure, don't want to fall in line, because it's not about falling in line, in my view. It's about voting for equality, voting for education, voting for healthcare, voting for reproductive rights, voting for everything that we want, for the American dream that it's not an American dream. It's everybody's dream. It's a human dream. So this is not a vote for Clinton. This is a vote for the country we want to stay. We want to become the people we want to be. So to me, that, you know, that's how I see it. And, you know, as a Latina woman, I've made it my mission. You know, I talk to friends. Most of my friends are younger and they all want to vote for Bernie Sanders and are big advocates. But, you know, I tell them, you are the one that may need an abortion. You're the one that's going to need, birth control. You know, how are you not going to vote for Hillary Clinton when we have only two options? It's Trump or it's everything that may make your life better, that may, you know, work in your progress and make your family safer, better. So to me, those are the options.
Does that mean then, though, that you don't support Hillary Clinton, that you would vote for Hillary Clinton, but that you don't necessarily support her over?
No. I support Hillary Clinton and I've, you know, raised money for her and I will continue to support her. But I do appreciate Bernie Sanders' role. I think Bernie Sanders has made this election a lot more interesting. He has brought to the discussion a lot of really important issues that nobody really wanted to talk about or did not have the courage to talk about. He's brought a lot of young people interested. He's brought a lot of people that wouldn't have voted or wouldn't have said anything before. So I do appreciate Bernie Sanders, and I think he's been good to a certain point. I also have some... You know, I don't like, you know, how long it's taken him for him to endorse Hillary when he was in a power position. I think he lost a key opportunity. But I am a Clinton supporter. But I also like Bernie.
All right. So as we wrap up this, the first part of the roundtable, I just want to go around the table. I think it's fairly obvious where you stand in terms of whom you will vote for. But I want to get it on record. John Barrow.
I'm pledged to support Hillary Clinton at the convention. I'm going to, and I'm going to vote for president in November.
Gigi Pedraza.
Hillary Clinton.
Khalid Kamau.
I am pledged to support Bernie Sanders, but I will support the Democratic nominee, whoever it is.
And that's what the party's all about. That's why we're still united.
Let's now turn to the issues, and I want to start with national security. This is one concept where many say Donald Trump may have an edge over Hillary Clinton. And with the rise of ISIS attacks and potential threats to national security, Secretary Clinton wants to intensify the air campaign against ISIS, as well as step up support for local Arab and Kurdish forces. Do you all agree that this is the way to go? And Gigi, let's start with you.
I don't know enough to have an opinion, honestly. I don't feel that I know enough to say yes or no, or I agree or I don't agree. I think the matter is too complicated.
Then let me ask you, how do you feel about Hillary Clinton in terms of national security?
Hillary, it's focused on bringing allies and people together. That's what I support. Versus Donald Trump, who's alienated everybody. You know, his narrative is always a narrative of fear, a narrative of them versus us. I don't support that, and I cannot support that.
Khalid.
I'm going to borrow a line from Republican Vice President Mike Pence and say, before I'm a Democrat or a progressive, I'm a Christian. And as a Christian, I believe, as Dr. Martin Luther King said, that a nation that spends more year after year on military defense than programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And I am very concerned. We now have been at war in the Middle East for 20 years. And the Middle East doesn't seem any more stable. We don't seem any more secure. I don't think that we know enough to be going into these communities of color that are non-Western and pick winners and losers. And so I do think that we need to get out of that business. Now, how we get out of it now that we're already in it, there is a whole, you know, you break it, you bought it ideology that I think that is very valid. And you can't just evacuate a place after you've, you know, bombed it to death. But I'm very concerned. And I think a lot of progressives are very concerned about the amount of money and blood and treasure that we have been spending there, even as we neglect our own infrastructure, our own schools, our own people.
I hear what Khalid's saying, and I honor and invoke the memory of Dr. King about how we ought to be allocating our resources. But I know that Dr. King respected a guy named Reinhold Niebuhr, a great theologian who in the last century made the case during the height of the Cold War that a great nation cannot withdraw and cannot not use the power it's got. But it can't use the power it's got without making some great mistakes. If you look and read what's being said by the folks who are senior folks in foreign affairs, there's a universal consensus that the Democratic candidate this time is the one who represents the stronger position on national defense, both by judgment, training, and experience.
Hillary Clinton says she'll push for what she terms common sense reform to gun control by advocating for comprehensive background checks. And John, you're pretty clear in your gun ownership that you are a gun owner and a strong Second Amendment proponent. Do you believe that Hillary Clinton is right on this?
We can have intelligent conversation about this in this country, but it's very difficult to do it with the polarization that exists between the two parties right now. And I also think it's important for folks on both sides of this issue to be dealing off the top of the deck and not off the bottom of the deck. The assault weapons ban, for example, that was passed in Clinton's day and was allowed to lapse in Bush's day, even when Bush professed to support its extension, but Congress wouldn't go along with it, was a massive failure. Another thing that I think that's sorely lacking in this debate is we've got a fundamentally different situation in this country in terms of crazy people and how we're treating crazy people. I mean, they're running loose because we have a policy in this country we've kind of backed into of deinstitutionalization and basically allowing not the inmates to run the asylum, but the inmates to be basically medicating themselves. And this ain't working. We need to take a much more progressive and assertive attitude on the problems of the mentally ill among us. We have too many people out there who are a danger to themselves and to others that we ought to be dealing with in a more assertive fashion, rather than treating everybody's access to a certain type of gun as the issue. It ought to be some people's access to any kind of gun.
So let me ask you then, what you're saying is the real issue with guns and violence in the U.S. is a mental health network issue?
Well, that certainly is a large part of what made up the situation in the 1960s. We had the guy in the tower. And there were crazy people, to be sure. But we didn't have the problem that we have today of so many people who are a danger to themselves and to others who are essentially not being managed at all. And this is a tough thing for our society because we've never figured out a balance on how to do this. Back in the 50s and 60s, we locked up people in mental institutions like in Milledgeville because they gave us the creeps. And that's not an appropriate policy. And so in the overreaction to that abuse and to the ready availability of drugs, which could sort of provide chemical straitjackets for folks, we've sort of tossed a whole bunch of people under the bus and forgotten about a whole bunch of people who are a real problem to us today.
And also, if I could just add in, you talked about inmates running the asylum. Like, the fact is that our prison system is our biggest biggest provider of mental health care services.
That's a very good point.
In this country. Absolutely. In every state, the largest mental health care provider is the prison industrial complex.
This has echoes of the Black Lives Matter versus Blue Lives Matter debate, too, because as the president so correctly pointed out, we're asking the law enforcement community to do so much more than they're really capable of doing.
And many in that law enforcement community would say that, look, if I didn't have to worry about people being on the streets better armed than I am, I would feel a lot better. I wouldn't worry as much, and I would be less prone to use my own gun.
And I'll have to agree with that. I have personally lost two friends to gun violence. My grandfather, a policeman, he was assaulted. He pulled his gun. The assaulter, of course, was faster. He used his gun and shot my grandmother with it. So I am a big proponent for gun control, for screenings, for domestic abusers, for people with behavioral health issues. I am for gun control.
Stronger gun control than there now is.
Yes. Absolutely.
And I just want to make sure that I'm clear on your stance, John Barrow. You are not for stronger gun control, just different.
Well, I am for enforcing the laws we got on the books a whole lot better and more efficiently than we are today. There's no question about that. But also, I think we've got a huge area of social responsibility that has fallen between the cracks of the state and the federal government. Mental health has always been seen as a job that was too big for local government, and yet not really the business of the federal government. And so traditionally, this has emerged as a program and a responsibility of state government. And it's atrophied and fallen by the way as the states have gotten out of the business and nobody's taken up the slack.
And one of the reasons I think that has happened is because there's not a lot of profit in it, particularly among indigent. We know that an overwhelming number of people that are killed by police actually have some sort of mental disability. And that an overwhelming number of people that are in prisons would on the street not be able to afford health care. So the ideas, and I think these are things that we can definitely agree on as Democrats in Georgia, Medicaid expansion.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And the expansion of affordable health care, including mental health care for working class and working poor people. I think that those are issues that we can all agree on. And Bernie and the 13 million people that voted for him pushing the party to the left on those issues has been very important in defining who we are as Democrats.
It's interesting that I've asked twice about gun control and all of you have brought up these bigger social issues. So you really do see it as more complex than just gun laws. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I want to move to education and get your thoughts on Secretary Clinton's plan to make college debt-free, where tuition at public colleges and universities would be based on a family's income.
Well, I want to smile about this. I mean, it's clear now that this is one of the reasons that Bernie withheld his endorsement of Secretary Clinton, is that this is one of the things that we're fighting for. He wanted to go even farther and have free public college. We are drowning in debt. You know, this generation of people is drowning in debt, even as salaries have not risen in the past 40 years. So it's a very, very key issue. And this is the thing that I have been telling progressives to try and keep us in this Democratic tent, that we put a lot of things in our platform. We passed the most. I was at the platform committee meetings and we passed the most progressive platform in history. Now, whether or not we enact any of those things into law, will be more about the will of our leaders and the resolve of our voters to make sure that those leaders carry that out and to give our Democratic president a Congress that they can work with. Because what we do know is that we could nominate Jesus Christ. And if Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are still controlling the Congress, we would not be able to get his agenda through. We would not be able to get his agenda voted on, you know, brought to the floor for a vote, let alone, passed or enacted into law.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with Khalid. And hopefully in Georgia, you can also move forward and, allow undocumented and DACA students to also participate to all the colleges, because education should be available for all.
Absolutely.
And John, it's important to point out that you were a Blue Dog Democrat when you were in the House.
Our last one.
And that means that you're conservative on a lot of issues, or considered conservative for a Democrat. Free education. Khalid said students walk away with a lot of debt. Is that just shifting the debt to the federal government?
It's an issue that involves serious complications, because the educational industrial complex we have today, and the for-profits, the good ones and the not-so-good ones, are ready like a bunch of lemurs to latch onto onto anything that's going to be put out there and take advantage of that, much more so than the land-grant colleges were in the 1940s when we came up with the GI Bill. So we had to be very careful about this. And I also think we have to recognize there's nothing free about this, but we recognize that it's a common good to have an educated workforce. And so we recognize common goods need to be, the burden of bearing those has to be spread out as far and wide as possible. I think the same goes for college.
one of the reasons that public schools, public colleges and universities are struggling is because there has been a long dwindling of public support, of taxpayer support for those schools. Should states be more responsible at this point for funding the schools within their borders?
Speaking of myself, I don't think there's any question that the state should assume more of the responsibility for this, if only because I think they can manage what they get for their money better than that they can from Washington. If you want to make sure that the money's not going to be swallowed up by phony diploma mills, let the folks who have a state university system to support be the ones who are putting money into the institutions they know are high quality because they're their institutions and the public sector institutions. And I think that's just invoking self-interest as well as common sense. But I also think that it's important for folks to realize that the states are withdrawing from nice-to-haves because they're having to spend so much on gotta-haves. They're spending more than they should on the criminal justice system. And I commend the governor for taking the first tentative steps toward trying to make our system more rational in terms of what we spend our money on. We ought to lock up people that scare us and not the people that we're just angry at or annoyed with. We ought to be locking up people who really are a threat to us, and I think that's a step in the right direction. But health care is also a huge burden that states are bearing that they shouldn't be, really. Medicaid expansion, if done properly, if it had been done better, would have basically taken this burden off of the backs of the states, where I think you've got so much going on right now in gamesmanship in one state, and then nobody really has any idea how different Medicaid is in Georgia, for example.
Khalid, I know where you would jump in here and say the answer would probably be single payer for healthcare.
Yeah, I would go beyond that. One of the things that we saw, Donald Trump promised a lot of these things. I mean, he had an hour and 15 minute speech full of promises. Republicans have continued to promise to make America great again without having Americans to have to pay anything for it. And so there is this pressure, there's this downward pressure to cut taxes and cut all of these social programs without raising the federal minimum wage, which you haven't done in 20 years. So I think that hopefully in this election, what we will see is a ripple that happens not just at the top with our Democratic president, but we'll see that ripple down through Congress and to the state legislatures.
Absolutely. And if there's a single thing that I believe we could do in Georgia to better the lives of, you know, people of color and minorities, really people that need the most, is to expand Medicare.
Medicaid, just to make sure I'm on the same page with you, correct?
Correct. More and more the people that fall in the gaps are families that make a little bit too much, they don't make enough, and I see it every day, and it's horrible, and it affects the people that need it most.
Much has been made about Donald Trump's stance on immigration. How do you think Hillary Clinton will handle the issue? Gigi, let's start with you.
Hillary's platform, first of all, is not true. Donald Trump said on his speech that she wants amnesty for all. There has never been a conversation about that. I think she does want to uphold DACA and DAPA. She believes in immigration reform. She wants to focus on deporting people that are actually a threat to everybody. But she does believe in keeping families united. And she also wants all refugees and people looking for asylum to have a fair shot so that their stories can be heard. So that is a platform that I think everybody can stand behind, that actually most of Americans stand behind, versus, you know, putting a wall, which it's really stupid. I mean, majority of immigrants don't even, you know, jump a wall.
Khalid.
I agree with everything she said completely.
I don't want to be an outlier here, but I do believe personally that we have a basis for resolving the illegal immigrant problem in this country that nobody's focusing on, and that's just doing it in the right order. If we were to take care of the public safety issue first, I'm convinced that Americans working together would address the humanitarian issue in the best and most generous spirit possible. But you can't expect folks to address the humanitarian issue if their concerns about the public safety issue are not being adequately met, and if there's still a large number of people who are coming in this country whose illegal entry can be prevented but isn't. And so that's the conversation I think we need to have. Both parties, I think, need to do a better job of talking about what we can come together on that issue than we've seen up till now. And I don't think both sides are very polarized on this issue among others.
If you could explain for me what you mean by a public safety issue versus a humanitarian issue.
Well, the public safety issue is to make sure that folks aren't coming in this country haven't got a right to. That bad guys aren't coming in here, or folks aren't coming in here for economic immigration reasons who are jumping the line ahead of other folks and just coming in on their own, just coming in illegally. Illegal entry in this country is a public safety issue.
I just want to make sure that I'm not reading more into what you're saying than I should. And the public safety issue being people who come here illegally represent a threat to safety?
No, I'm just saying that I'm using that as an overarching rubric to deal with several issues of lawlessness. Folks coming here and overstaying their visas. Folks coming in illegally because they want a job that's available on our side of the border, not available on their side of the border. They want to raise their families back home, but they want to earn income here. All those things having a depressing effect on wages in America. There are a lot of public safety is probably is not the best route term to lump all of that stuff under, but basically making sure that the immigration that takes place in this country is legal.
I do believe comprehensive reform is needed, but as long as we think that immigration is a public threat or a safety threat, it's not going to move forward. And I really don't understand what you mean by that. People come here mostly for two reasons, because they want to work, they need a job, which they usually find here, and because they want to study. And a lot of people stay after graduating from Georgia Tech, from Georgia State, from UGA, from wherever university, and work a low-paying job because there's no way, no path to get a green card or whatever. Documentation is needed. And at the same time, the same thing for people that come looking for a job. And it's not a humanitarian issue. It's also a business issue. The majority of crops and strawberries and Vidalia onions and everything are picked by immigrants, and by immigrants that move state by state because this is the way they live. And specifically in Georgia, we don't have, the state has changed. It's no longer a state that has one male sending money back. The majority of immigrants here are young immigrants. The average age is 26 years old, and it's young families. So I don't see the public safety issue.
You have to really be careful with our language when we're talking about both public safety and national security. We talk a lot about good guys and bad guys. To invoke Dr. King again, America is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. And we'll never have true solutions until we address that.
JG, you get the last word.
I agree, and I also believe that we should not generalize or stereotype. We cannot say that all immigrants are, a danger. We cannot say Mexicans are all rapists.
Exactly.
We cannot say anything like that. A student that overstays his visa 2 days, cannot be put in the same pot as, an extremist come and bomb. I absolutely believe in immigration, and I also think it's a humanitarian issue, but it's also very much a business issue. In Georgia, you have the largest and fastest growing group of business owners, which is Latinas. 3 out of 4 businesses are open for immigrants. So immigration, it's a huge plus when we talk about our country. And it is a business issue, and it is a humanitarian issue. And I think if you see it as Democrats as a business issue, actually, it's much more better, because I think we lack from that. A lot of times, of course, this is a stereotype from, the right, that they see us as, we're just the nice guys, the humanitarian. But no, it's also a business issue, so.
Practical and pragmatic.
I think so.
All right. Again, thank you all for your time. It's been a lively discussion, and just like the Republican roundtable, there's agreement, disagreement. At the end of the day, though, what I hear is we all want to make our country better for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.